Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. This week, Vayishlach. This week, please take a moment to rate the podcast. Your ratings definitely help us out, and we appreciate your time to rate us on iTunes or from wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much. This week, Vayishlach with Rabbi Alex Israel. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week we're going to turn our attention to the dramatic episode of the actions of Shimon and Levi in Shechem. The story, of course, is that Dina, the daughter of Yaakov and Leah, was raped and abducted in the city of Shechem, raped by Shechem, who is the crown prince of the town. And the story ends with Shimon and Levi, her brothers, killing the inhabitants of Shechem in an act of retribution, and extracting Dina from the town. And the issue that I would like to deal with is the legitimacy of this action, or maybe more accurately, how we relate to the use of power, the use of violence in difficult moral situations. As I record this podcast, a little in advance of Parashat Vayishlach, we've just been experiencing a huge wave of rocket fire from Gaza into Israel, over 300 rockets overnight, and Tzahal are retaliating and firing into Gaza. On the one hand, I am delighted that we live in an era in which we have power to defend ourselves, in which Jews as a people and Israel as a nation, that we're not vulnerable, that we are able to engage in defense. On the other hand, we need to be fully cognizant that along with this great firepower comes huge responsibility, huge moral responsibility. And when I think about the parasha of Shimon and Levi and their usage of power, and many would say their abuse of their power, many of these questions are raised. So it's these issues that we're going to address today in our short time together. And obviously, we will not be able to deal with the absolute complexity and the detailed way in which this topic needs to be addressed. But within the confines of a few short minutes on Parashat Shavua, I hope we will be able to articulate something worthwhile. I'm not going to deal with the text of the story of Dina and Shechem. I'm going to jump right to the end, where there is a conversation between Yaakov, the father, and Shimon and Levi, the sons. And we read the following. Vayoma Yaakov el Shimon ve'en Levi, achartem oti lahavisheni biyoshev ha'aretz, vaknani uvaprizi, vani matei mispar, v'nesfu alai, v'hikuni v'nishmadeti ani uveiti. Vayomru, hachazonaya aset achotenu. Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, you have brought trouble upon me. You've made me smell bad amongst the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And we, our camp, are few in number. When they unite against us and attack us, v'nishmadeti ani uveiti, me and I and my whole house will be killed. Yaakov here seems to be leveling at Shimon and Levi that their actions of murdering the inhabitants of Shechem are reckless and that they're going to bring destruction on the whole family. The Canaanites and Perizzites, we're few in number, they are numerous, and if they unite against us, we will be destroyed. The two sons, Shimon and Levi, respond, Hachazonaya aset achotenu? Should our sister be treated like a whore? They get the last word in this story. What are the arguments of Yaakov, and what are the arguments of Shimon and Levi? At first level, Yaakov seems to be expressing a timid, fearful approach. One might say actually a pragmatic approach, where he says, listen, we're a small family, 12 sons are small, maybe with a few servants and what have you, but we're vulnerable, we're strangers of the land, we have no rights, we don't have large clans or tribes. And if you go and kill an entire town in Canaan, soon the surrounding villages and their relatives will come and they will gang up against us and kill us. What you did was lacking in prudency, it was highly reckless, and this is going to bring ruin on all of us. Shimon and Levi respond, are you going to treat our sister as a whore? What are they saying? Maybe they're saying, we don't want to be pragmatic, we don't want to be prudent. There's a question of pride here. Dad, Yakov, you are talking in terms of, you know, whether this will be dangerous or what, but our sister has been abducted in Shechem. We don't want to be in a situation in which we act prudently. We want to stand for her honor. There is a certain dignity of the family. And we have to act, because otherwise, how are we going to be treated? One could actually possibly read this exchange slightly differently. Yaakov could be expressing a certain perspective of appeasement and say, you know, we can't walk around killing people. It'll be dangerous for us. And they're responding from a pragmatic perspective too, and saying, actually, Dad, you're wrong. If we let ourselves get pushed around, then we'll be vulnerable. But when we stand up for ourselves, then we will not be vulnerable. But whichever way you cut it, Yaakov here does not challenge Shimon and Levi on moral grounds. He doesn't express disapproval of what they do, other than for the fact that it will be dangerous for the family. This is not the case, though, several years later, on Jacob's deathbed. Because as Jacob is about to die, Yaakov turns around to Shimon and Levi and talks very differently. And this is what he says there. Shimon v'Levi achim klei chamas mecherotehem. Shimon and Levi, who are brothers, their weapons are tools of lawlessness. Let my person not be included in their council. Let not my being be counted in their assembly. Ki ba'apam hirgu ish uvirtsunami krushor. For when they're angry, they slay men. And when they are, and in their desire, they uproot oxen. Aror apam ki az. Let their anger be cursed, because it is too strong. Ve'evratam, and let their fury, ki kashata, be cursed, because it is too relentless. I will divide them in Yaakov, scatter them in Israel. This sounds like something far more critical. Cursing their anger, he curses them and says, I don't want to be in their council, I don't want to be in their assembly. Yaakov on his deathbed seems to relate to their action in a far more critical way. Why was he only pragmatic at the time, and why was he critical later on in life? One might suggest a few possible approaches. One is that Yaakov, even at the time, disapproved of their actions, but he thought it wasn't prudent to say anything at the time. As Mishnah Avot says, Al taratze adam b'shar ka'aso, don't try and placate somebody when they are angry. When somebody's angry, you're not going to get anywhere with them. You have to wait till they calm down to reason with them. At the time, had he disagreed with them, Shimon and Levi, we heard their mood, should you treat our sister as a whore? They wouldn't have been able to hear anything. It could even be that he doesn't say anything a year afterwards or 2 years afterwards, because when's going to be a convenient moment to say this? But on his deathbed, he feels a need to say that which he felt right from the start, that he felt that their anger was too extreme and that they acted in a rash and immoral way. That's one possibility. However, we're going to raise some others. Before we get there, I just do want to relate to a debate which takes place about Shimon and Levi's actions in Shechem. Indeed, were their actions moral or were they immoral? Here there is an argument between Rambam Maimonides and Nachmanides, the Ramban. Maimonides in Mishneh Torah, Law of Kings, chapter 9, says that Shimon and Levi were perfectly within their rights and were correct in their actions in Shechem. After all, their sister had been raped brutally and had been abducted. It's true that Shechem offers a marriage proposal, but this was merely a cover-up for what had been a brutal and illegitimate crime. Moreover, this had been done publicly. The inhabitants of Shechem knew what their leader had done. They were all bystanders, and they were all accomplices, because they let this go by. Let's stress that Dina had not been returned to the family. She still remained within the castle of Shechem and Hamor. She had not been returned to her father and brothers. And therefore they were holding this girl almost like blackmail. Were the family of any position to be able to refuse the overtures of marriage when they hadn't even seen their wounded sister? And since they saw the entire town as accomplices to this crime, they were simply whitewashing the whole thing and accepting that their crown prince could engage in rape and could engage in abduction unhindered. The entire town were in collusion and were guilty. That is the opinion of Maimonides. Nachmanides disagrees. He says, first of all, the sons of Jacob had no right to try and to punish the people of Shechem, even if they were guilty. And having said that, he said, that wasn't what Jacob agreed to at the time at all. When Jacob agrees to a certain duplicity or subterfuge, what he agrees is to agree to the marriage proposal, indeed, as a ruse, as a lie, assuming that the people will probably not circumcise themselves, that the men of Shechem will not agree to be circumcised just for their crown prince, and they'll all disagree and they'll get Dinah back. Should the people actually comply and go through with the deal on the third day when the men were all in pain and immobilized, they would simply kidnap Dinah back, retrieve her, and leave the town and not kill anybody. And even in the worst case scenario, who would be killed? Says the Ramban, the only moral thing was to kill the rapist himself and nobody else. Shimon and Levi, however, and the other brothers, wanted revenge on the people of Shechem, and this, in Yaakov's eyes, was illegitimate. And therefore there's a very interesting debate between our leading commentators, whether Shimon and Levi were totally out of their moral grounds, whether their act was a crime or their act was justified. So let's go back to our central question. Yaakov, the father, seems to raise pragmatic concerns at the time. Oh, we're all going to get killed, but doesn't say anything moral. But at a later date, he seems to say something which really criticizes Shimon and Levi. Where is the real truth here? I'd like to give two approaches by two different commentators. The first is Rav Hirsch, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, leader of modern orthodoxy in Germany in the 19th century, has a fascinating approach. He says, talks about Shimon and Levi in some way justified, but in other ways totally wrong. Let me read some of his debate, some of his comment. He says, "Shall our treater be treated as a whore? This gives their whole motive. The local lord, in other words, Shechem, would never have allowed himself to act as he did if it were not a question of a foreign, friendless, forsaken Jew girl. That was the thought that brought home to the minds of Shimon and Levi that there are times when the family of Jacob, too, must grasp the sword and protect the purity and honor of their women. They had no desire to act practically. They wanted to make themselves feared so that nobody would attempt anything similar. The daughters of Jacob were not to be considered as being at anybody's disposal. But," continues Rav Hirsch, "they went too far to take revenge on innocent people for what powerful ones had done. It is only the means which they took, and they're going much too far in the use of them, that is blameworthy. The motive that moved them, the purpose they were striving for, was holy and a most justified one. The spirit with which they were filled is an indispensable one for a family that had to wander among the nations of the world, had to allow the bitterest fate to pass over them, and to endure the deepest degradation, yet to remain upstanding with all the elasticity of spirit and nobleness of mind for their world historic revival to an everlasting path through history which is unparalleled. On his deathbed, we see the old father expressing his curse on the means, on the excessive passion, but his blessing of the recognition of the motive and spirit which lay behind them." Here, Rabbi Hirsch points out something fascinating. He says that indeed, Shimon and Levi's action was immoral, but that doesn't mean that everything they did was inappropriate. And in fact, he goes back to Yaakov's curse. And Yaakov says, "Achal kein bi Yaakov afitzein bi Israel. I will divide them up in Israel, and I will scatter them in Israel." And he says, dividing up doesn't mean obliterating something. It means diluting it. It means apportioning it out. If we go back to Jacob's curse, what does he say? He says, "Shimon and Levi are a pair. Let my person not be included in their council, b'kahalam, when they are kahal, when they are together. Let my not being be counted in their assembly." In other words, Shimon and Levi's sense of anger, its root is in a deep sense of pride, a deep sense of the dignity of Israel. That needs to be apportioned out to the entire nation. However, when it is concentrated, when it is assembled, then it is dangerous and then it can engage in actions which are indeed unethical, which are indeed violent and unjustified. And therefore, he says, there is an ambivalence in Yaakov's relationship to Shimon and Levi. He understands that what they did came from a very pure place, but he also doesn't want anybody misunderstanding that their action was moral. And therefore, he says, let them be apportioned out to the whole nation. As he continues and says, and I quote, military powers of decision should never lie in their hands, but on their other hand, their strong spirit, always conscious of its own worth and Israel's lofty destiny, should come into contact with every sphere of the whole nation, actively imparting and teaching its life-giving, sustaining and saving effects. So far from a full condemnation, Rav Hirsch divides up their motivation and the spirit which animates them from their immoral actions. I find this really quite a fascinating approach, because far from what the Ramban does, which says they're simply wrong in what they did, he is very true to the spirit of the parsha, where they get the last say. They say, "Hachazonah yaseh tachotenu," should our sister be treated as a whore? And this is the last ringing line of chapter 34. Yaakov comes out as being somewhat timid in the way that he relates to them, fearful, worried about the safety of the family, but not standing up for his daughter at all. And therefore he says that in his sage old age, Yaakov understands that there was some aspect of what they did which was worthy, but that they should not have indeed engaged in what was a massacre of the town. So this is really a fascinating approach. I'd like to quote a very interesting article that I came across, which will be our sort of second perspective on all of this. And this comes from a rabbi from Alon Shavut, whose name is Rav Yehuda Shaviv. And what's fascinating about this piece is that he wrote it in the central magazine of the settler movement of Gush Emunim. The magazine or the journal is called Nekuda. It's not published anymore, but it was written in 1984. And I'll reflect back to 1984 when I quote what he says. Rav Yehuda Shaviv says that indeed, at the time, Yaakov was worried about pragmatics, but it was on his deathbed that he came and criticized Shimon and Levi with full moral force. Why? Why later on in life did he realize that what they had done had been so problematic? And he says, Rav Yehuda Shaviv, that it was only after the Joseph affair, when the brothers had tried to murder their own brother, that the damage of the Shechem affair came into such sharp focus. He relates to a comment of Rashi on that curse of Yaakov to his sons, where he says on his deathbed, "Ki ba'apam hirgu ish uvirtzonam ikrushar." In their anger, they slayed a man, and when they were pleased, they maimed or they killed an oxen, uprooted an ox. And he says, Rashi says, "Who was the man? It was Shechem. In their anger, they killed a man. That is Shechem uvirtzonam ikrushar." And through their free-willed action, they uprooted the ox. Who is the ox? That is Joseph, who is called Bechor Shoro. In other words, the actions of Shechem paved the path to the attempted murder of their own brother, of Yosef. And here I will quote what Rav Shaviv says at the time. He says, Rav Shaviv says in his article, he says, "Not for nothing did Yaakov combine these two different and distant events, for he saw a line leading directly from the slaying of the men of Shechem to the desire to kill Yosef. True, the men of Shechem deserved to die, but that was not why Shimon and Levi slew them. They were seeking a release for their rage and anger. Whoever feels free to let out his anger, even on guilty Gentiles, will ultimately try to commit fratricide, for rage has no bounds and no limits. Whoever breaches the walls of morality in an all-consuming rage will ultimately breach it entirely, and something which began in anger will turn into deliberate action, to God forbid, an accepted norm of life." Rav Shaviv understands like this. At the time, maybe there was a sense of moral confusion about Shimon and Levi's action in Shechem. Maybe there was a sort of doubt, like the doubt between Maimonides and Nachmanides. Maybe Yaakov said to himself, maybe, look, really, after all, the whole inhabitants of Shechem were accomplices, were bystanders. On the other hand, my sons just killed a whole town. On the other hand, they raped my daughter. On the other hand, it seems they went too far. But, he says, people have allowed themselves to murder and kill in a state of vengeance and retribution without trial and jury. Well, eventually, that violence will seep into their lives and they will start using violence and murder as a way to resolve their problems. And therefore, later on, when the brothers see Joseph as an irritating adversary, as somebody who challenges their leadership of the family, what's the first thing they think of doing to him? L'chuvan hargehu. Hine bala chalamot alazeba. L'chuvan hargehu. Here is this dreamer coming. Let us kill him. Retrospectively, as Yaakov reflects back on the sale of Yosef, he realizes that it all began in Shechem, and that he should have criticized their actions in Shechem and given them the indication that murder was not the way to solve their dispute. Why did Rav Shaviv write this in 1984? I don't know. But I know what was going on in 1984 in the settler movement, and I know what was going on, because, of course, in 1982, after the Israeli withdrawal from Sinai, that's when the Lebanon War broke out. And during the Lebanon War was the massacre by Christian militia in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. Now, this created a huge debate in Israel. The Israeli mainstream and left wing called for a commission of inquiry. But many of the right wing said, this is not our problem. If our Christian allies killed Palestinians, why should we be responsible? The left wing and the mainstream said, well, it was on our watch. We were in Beirut at the time. They were our allies. On the right wing, they said, listen, these are terrorists anyway. If they were killed, so be it. The very next year, at a Shalom Akshav demonstration, somebody hurled a grenade into the Peace Now demonstration, and a young man called Emil Greenzweig was killed. I wonder whether Rav Shaviv was saying this. He said, you turned a blind eye when Palestinians were killed in Beirut. They weren't killed by a Jew, they were killed by Christian phalangists, but it was on our watch. And you said, this is not our problem. You were deaf to the death, or rather the killing, of human beings. And later this is kind of going to come to visit you within Israeli society. Many people had the same feeling after the Baruch Goldstein massacre, where certain rabbis on the right weren't quick to condemn the murder of 29 Palestinians in the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, which took place in the middle of the Second Intifada, took place in the middle of a period in which there was a tremendous amount of bloodshed in the whole process of the Oslo Accords. And then the very next year, Yitzhak Rabin was shot, was assassinated. People who can't speak up about non-Jews who are killed because they justify it this way and that might well find that murder becomes a way of resolving disputes. If you're not sensitive to murder of even Gentiles, then you might find that within your society, murder becomes a way of solving problems. I mention all of this political history because what Rav Shaviv is saying is that this story really does contain the seeds of something very important, a very important warning about that when you unleash violence, sometimes it takes on a life of its own. When you start engaging in killing, it needs to be very carefully controlled. The moral critique must be very exacting, or else murder has a way of multiplying itself, and like a virus, it metamorphosizes and comes into other places. Maybe less prudent and less ethical people feel that they have a license to kill as well. I think all of this is really fascinating in our current reality, because reality is never 100% clear, and certainly when we are engaging in conflict, as we are here on a constant basis here in the land of Israel, as I started in my opening words, we are very, very happy that we have the opportunity not to be vulnerable and helpless in our current reality. For too long, in our history of the Jewish people, Jews were helpless and their blood was spilt without any ability to be able to offer any comeuppance or any retribution, any defense, and any deterrence. And yet now we have tremendous firepower at our disposal. And the thing that I value about this whole debate between chapter 34 in Bereishit and chapter 49, between Yaakov's words and Shimon and Levi's response at the time, and Yaakov's curse on his deathbed, is that it really enables us to try and debate the virtues and the dangers of Jewish power. That on the one hand, Jewish power is essential for us to have in order to keep ourselves safe. On the other hand, taking life is not something which can be treated lightly, and that taking life in one situation can have severe ramifications and can have severe implications for the moral landscape in which we live, and that we constantly need to be on our guard to make sure that we keep our moral compass in the right direction, that we have that we check ourselves and that we examine our ways to make sure that we are on the correct side of ethics, on the correct side of the law, and that we use our power wisely and morally. Thank you very much. Wishing you all a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.